My name is Sandra Barrett, and on behalf of University College of Syracuse University, it's my pleasure to welcome you here today to the pre-election Thursday morning roundtable. Now, I say that with confidence. I'm going to say that next week is going to be the post-election, but I say that with less confidence because I've lived through other elections where we thought we were going to be talking about post-election the week after. But if all goes well, next week, David Rubin and Ivory Tower half-hour panelists will be here for a full hour to talk about the elections that will occur next Tuesday. And also then in 2 weeks at the November 15th Institute for Retired Professionals or Retired People, Bob McClure will be talking also post-election. So we are very fortunate to have with us today Professor Robert McClure, Professor of Political Science and Public Affairs at the Maxwell School. If you got the email, those of you who don't have email, we did not have time to tell you yesterday that New York State Comptroller Tom DiNapoli, because of the effects of Superstorm Sandy in New York and Long Island, is not able to be with us today. He's very sorry. He had to cancel a whole slew of appointments here in Syracuse today and hopes that we'll be able to reschedule. But be that as it may, we are very, very, very appreciative that Bob McClure was able to be with us today. Needs no introduction, but I will remind you that he's the Chapel Family Professor of Citizenship and Democracy Emeritus at SU, former Associate Dean and Senior Associate Dean, and one of our all-time favorite speakers. So thank you very much, Professor McClure.
Thank you, Sandy. It's nice to be back. It's been a while since I've seen all these familiar faces. This is just one more example of hurricane damage. you have a hurricane and the real speaker, and I waft up on your shores. I'm sorry about the hurricane, but it's good to be back. I also thought we might do a little something that you may not be expecting. Americans believe in elections. We believe that elections will cure anything that ails us. We vote more often for more things than anybody else in the world. We vote in primaries. We vote to elect people. Then we turn around and vote to unelect people. We vote in on laws, bill the size of billboards. We vote on school budgets. We vote and we vote and we vote and we vote, thinking somehow or another, if we just vote one more time, we'll straighten things out. But alas, that is a romantic notion. So rather today than just get back down in the weeds, I'll leave that to the Ivory Tower folks next week. They've got an easier task than I do. Come 9 o'clock next Wednesday morning, I have a group of South Asian journalists that I'm supposed to explain the outcome of the election to. Christ, we won't even know the outcome of the election at that point. But rather than to get down in the weeds and begin to talk with you about the male gun owners and the single moms in suburban Cincinnati, I want to try to put the election in a somewhat larger context for us to think about. If you wish to talk about the voters in the 18th precinct in Cleveland, after I'm finished, I'm happy to try to indulge you. But for the moment, let's try to talk about the election in a much larger context. I come to American elections in the context of thinking about what I call the three great divides. We're divided as a nation. We're divided as government. And we're divided as people politically. Those divides are persistent and abiding, and they shape and color all elections, their outcomes, and their aftermaths. If we fail to appreciate how deep these divides are, how permanent they are, we'll never quite get our head around what we can do and what we can't do, what elections mean and what they don't mean. Now, I want to begin with these three divides in the order of their importance, at least to me. We're a divided nation. Always have been. I suspect we're always gonna be. Culture is much more enduring than politics. Culture trumps politics almost always. You're all familiar with this. What is it? It's the old red and blue map. God bless the red and blue map. This is 2000. Looks a little different. But the basic structure remains the same. What's this one? This year. Okay. Could be. Actually, what is it? What? Are you close? What'd you say? Oh, hell, you've been there before. He heard this yesterday. That doesn't count. Besides, you didn't remember. 1896. Now, we had a lot of things go on between 1896 and 2008, but the basic underlying cultural fundamentals of this country didn't shift at all. Culture persists and persists and persists. That's what makes it culture. Now, in point of fact, I did play a little trick on you here with this map. I switched the parties. The colors switched. In this map, actually, the red was blue and the blue was red. But that's because in 1960 or thereabouts, the fundamental positions of the parties on race changed. And race is the great divider of American politics. We always have a white party and a party that embraces others. And when that switch took place, the parties, the partisanship switched, but the underlying culture remained the same. You'll recall in 2004 that President Obama, then Senator Obama, in his speech in Boston, said to us that we are not a red America or a blue America. We're the United States of America. It's a nice, romantic dream. But I wonder if he has the same views today. We're deeply divided. We have been from the very beginning. We tried a constitution. The Articles of Confederation didn't work because we couldn't get agreement. We scrapped it. We tried another one. We couldn't get agreement. And at the point of a gun, we killed 700,000 Americans to try to come to some, as Lincoln put it, new nation. And then, while occupying the South, we passed the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment, and we entered that new nation a third constitution. And we struggle today, as we did in the very beginning, to find a more perfect union. Now, in no small part, these divisions are the result of different people settling in different places with different values, different religions, different habits, different ways of life, but in one land. If you really want to try to understand American politics, in my view, I recommend to you a recent book elaborating on this old theme by Colin Woodard. It's called American Nations, Plural. Subtitled, A History of the 11 Rival Regional Cultures of North America. People of different perspectives settled America. Ah, there's all that, those old Yankees. We remember, we're kind of up here in Yankee land here. All us old Yankees. And then we spread over, we spread over here. Well, George, we're over here, settled over there. And then there's my tribe. I ain't a Yankee. I'm what he calls, I'm in Greater Appalachia. I'm a Scot-Irish. I've been a strepper since I left Scotland in 1750. The British were glad to get rid of me. My wife considers me an oppositional personality. Whatever you tell me, I'll tell you the other thing. I don't like government. Leave me alone. She points out that all across that part where Greater Appalachia was, we're all what were called barn burners. She says, get him mad, he'll burn your barn down. Those cultures endure and endure and endure. Yankee Massachusetts, Cavalier Mississippi, Cowboy, Texas. They don't agree. They don't even like one another. And they don't know much about one another. They got lots of stereotypes, but they really don't know one another. But they've got to kind of live together in a single government. It's hard going. Founders understood this, the second of the great divides. They divided the government. We ain't no France. We're not even Denmark. We're not a homogeneous, unitary government. In a small little country. We're a big country, spread from here to there, full of difference and pluralism and a federal structure. founders trying to cope with all of this difference and trying to do the best they can to allow free people to govern themselves in this vast pluralism. And suspicious of government as they were, founders were folks who wanted a central government that could do things, but a limited number of things. And they wanted them to do it, be able to do it, only if there was consent. Remember that part in the Declaration of Independence? We are all created equal and we got these rights. But we don't tend to want to remember the next part. That to secure these rights, a just government relies on the consent of the governed. Consent is at the bottom line of democracy. Governments don't do things to me. I agree to have them done. Damn. So they divided up this central government in that thing we call separation of powers. We keep wanting to forget that. The bulk of domestic power belongs to the Congress, not the president. They divided that up, Senate and the House. Then they chopped up all that power to begin with and gave most of it to the states, folks. Drives me bats. When candidates for the president run around saying they're going to change American education when donkeys fly. Not going to happen, folks. Not from there. The structure won't allow it. Presidents don't run the country. So we can say one thing for certain, almost for certain. Nothing's ever for certain in politics. We can say one thing almost for certain about this upcoming election. The government will still be divided. States will still be there, doing what states do. Central government will still be there. But the House of Representatives will still be Republican. Senate of the United States will still be Democratic. Gridlock. We're going to hold an election. But the culture is going to be the same. And the basic contours of government will not change. Perhaps we wish it were otherwise, but it's not. Now, it ought not surprise anyone then that if we've got these enduring cultural differences and we've got this divided government structure, that when you get down to ordinary, everyday, walking around public opinion, we don't agree there either. We're a deeply divided people. Oh, sure, we can see it in all sorts of ways. Presidential approval. About half the folks approve of President Obama, about half don't. Surprise. To ask people in the generic congressional ballot, it's a standard question we ask, if the election were held today, would you vote for the Republican candidate for Congress or the Democratic candidate for Congress? Well, as of yesterday, this thing fluctuates around zero. As of yesterday, it was 1.1% Republican. Divided again. Now, there are some things you can say, well, there are some things that we seem to have an overwhelming consensus on. Are we on the right track or the wrong track? Oh, boy, can we agree about that? 60, 65% of us all know that we're on the wrong track. But we don't agree on how to get on the right track. All that is masking the disagreement. We all wrong track. But then, how should we get on the right track? Disagreement again. If this election is about anything substantive, it is about the Affordable Health Care Act. Opinion from the get-go, all the way through, split down the middle. Little movement one way or the t'other. What we see at every turn, from the individual all the way up, across broad cultural differences, is that we are a deeply divided nation. Now, you would think, after 2 years, well, at least 2 years, of all of this political campaigning and nonsense, upwards of $2, $3, $4 billion, depending on how you count, $4 billion spent, that something should have changed, but we're right back where we started. Because culture trumps politics. When I was more active as a political operative, one of those campaign folks, some political operatives back here smiled when I said that. People used to ask me, do campaigns make a difference? And I'd say, yeah. About 50% of what I do and what we spend makes a difference. The only problem is I don't know which 50%. Now, on my porch up in Canada during the summertime, listening to NPR, probably with a gin and tonic, I heard two current, high-priced, high-powered political operatives, one a Democrat, one a Republican, talking about this year's presidential election. This will show you how far we've come in campaign technique and so forth, how much smarter we've gotten. It's true. They asked, do campaigns matter? And both of them said the same thing. Yeah, they matter. About 20% of what I do matters, but I don't know which 20%. So from the time I got out of politics to now, we've lost 30% of our capacity. It's a highly uncertain business. And it has, at best, effects around the margins. So has this campaign had any effect at all? Well, sure, some. In Ohio. Yeah, I'm going to get to Ohio. It all comes down to Ohio in all probability. And there, we probably have seen some of the effects of all this nonsense that we've all gone through. Tom Patterson and I wrote a book a long time ago in which we said that if you were going to run political ads, and they were really good, ads are a good way to communicate. You may not like them, but they're good. Do them early, and do them often, and do them on a blank screen. President Obama spent a ton of money and produced hundreds, thousands of ads and beamed them into Ohio to define the blank slate Mitt Romney. And it worked. Shaped Romney into a figure that was pretty unattractive. And it was probably a good campaign strategy, given that the underlying fundamentals of life in America, the right track, wrong track, the economy, if you had to take responsibility for that, you wouldn't want to run for re-election under those circumstances. They're not good ones. He should lose. But he damages the goods early on in Ohio. Now, he also had the advantages of incumbency. He took some action that helped a lot of auto workers, and a lot of them live in Ohio. So incumbency helped him there in that particular setting. Now along come the debates. Now debates don't usually do very much, and these didn't do very much either. They're a mess. We all know they're a mess. They're gibberish. Nonsense. One piece of nonsensical nonsense after another. And no side owns less nonsense than another here. It's just nonsense. But good bit of evidence that suggests that what debates do is to level the playing field for a moment for a challenger against an incumbent. And that what matters most about a debate is not what you and I saw, which we all know was nonsense, but what Stan tells us the next 72 hours about who won the damn thing. That shapes what we think the debate was about. The press says that Romney wins the first debate. You and I can be the judge of that. But the press said he did. And he stands up there and, well, I won't say what I said yesterday because this is on the radio, but you can tell him what I said yesterday. And he managed to get off the stage with the same guy who was president. And what you then see after that is that his evaluation as a potential president shifts. He is actually now viewed in public opinion slightly more favorably than the president. Not much. Basically, they both are disliked. But all of that is simply coming back. He just picked up what he should have had all along from the natural standing of the fundamentals of politics at the time. And we're back to a closely divided electorate and election. Indeed, it will turn out basically to be based on turnout. Who gets out whom? Do you get out your own base? It'll be a struggle. It'll be close. And you can see it in the polls. This is what the polls are struggling with. Likely voters. Who are likely voters? We all lie to them about whether we're going to vote or not. Some of us are more reliable than others. But almost nobody tells a pollster, nah, ain't ever going to vote. So we got to try to figure out who among all these people who are talking to us are actually going to vote. That's difficult. And we don't have a good formula for that. We have a good formula for drawing a sample. But we don't have a good algorithm for screening out the unlikely voters from the likely voters. And that's why you see the variation that you see. And that's why it's likely to be a long night come Tuesday night, trying to wait and see who actually did show up where. But I come back to where I began. We can expect little to be accomplished by this election, because whoever wins the presidency will face a divided government and a divided people. Democracy is still based on consent, and whoever wins will have no mandate, will have no broad basis of consensus. All whoever wins the presidency can do is either to try to shove down the throats of the other America his particular agenda and his party's agenda, or to bide time, try to build consensus over time a long time to get the American people to a point where they consent. America was one nation, in my view, only once in most of our lifetimes. That was in that period from the Depression to the end of World War II, where we were forced together in similar circumstances. We were all living alike. We were all in the trenches together. We were all in the armories together. We were all in the same circumstance together. And that one nation during that time produced what most of us have come to label the greatest generation. But that one nation faded quickly back into the old cultures. To get consent, to get one nation, will either take extraordinary circumstances or much time and discussion with people that we don't know and we don't like. Be sure to vote on November 6th. Oh, okay. I got to go back up there then?
You've got to
okay.
go up there.
All right.
All right. And, you know, I had one question prepared for you, not having any inkling really of what the theme of your talk was going to be. And my question was going to be, Professor McClure, what is the election going to change? But I think you've answered that one. So hopefully someone else has a question. Okay, great.
If we're to believe what you just shared with us.
Always be skeptical.
And I am. Share with me how a nation goes from a feeling either told to us by the media or a feeling in general from a 1980 malaise from the Carter years to a few years later a feeling of optimism. A nation of growth, transformation, as it were, if all that you just said, nothing changes.
I do not mean to convey that nothing changes. I do mean to convey that big national changes are hard to come by.
Feelings are easy. It's morning in America. Hope and change. We're a naive, romantic people. We want to believe that. But have any of our big, enduring, fundamental, underlying problems been dealt with? Has there been any real change? Is Medicare not going broke? Is Social Security on a long-term path to sustainability? Are American schools any better than they were in 1980 compared to the rest of the world? Is our health care any better compared with the rest of the world? I understand your point, but these deep underlying challenges are, in my view, not entirely dissimilar to the deep underlying challenge that race has posed to America throughout our history. We have made progress, but we still struggle. Now, that's not to say you can't at the margins make things a little better, maybe this decade over next decade. But this rhetoric that we want to use now, we listen to these candidates tell us they are going to transform everything. We're going to solve problems. We're going to make everything perfect. That's terrible language for democratic people to use, because it's not true. All I'm asking us here is to look squarely at reality. Campaigns are not a time for reality checks.
Good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
I have two questions. One's almost more of a comment. I noticed you didn't really talk much about the growing disparity of the haves and have-nots in our society and the impact that has on our political process. I was wondering if you could just address that briefly. And then secondly, you have an opportunity to work with, at least 100 bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, passionate young people every year. And what would you tell those people if they really wanted to impact change in our country? What path should they take if working via the existing systems and structures is inherently gridlock?
All good questions. I'll try to deal with both. There is no doubt that the growing inequality in the United States is both a practical political problem and a moral problem of great magnitude. But the hard truth of the matter, in my view, first, this is a problem in every Western developed democratic nation. There is a growing gap between the rich and the poor everywhere in the developed democratic world. It's maybe worse here, but it's everywhere. Part of that is a function of democracy itself. I have a piece that my bright-eyed and bushy-tailed students read by professor over in Rochester, who would want to argue that what democracy unleashes is the right to be unequal. He writes there that democracy revels in inequality. Now that's, I have students read that because it's provocative. but there is great truth to it, in the sense that democracy does allow people the freedom to go their own way and use their own talents. There are pitfalls with that, but to the degree that you do not have a homogeneous culture that is likely to provide some kind of really either provide at the outset a basic level of cultural equality, substantive equality now, or to be willing to provide the underlying big social safety net and redistribution that will limit that inequality. If you don't have those conditions, then democracy is likely to exacerbate inequality, not reduce it. Democracy says only that you will be politically equal. It doesn't say anything about substantive inequality. That's the cultural conditions. And democracy has a hard time where there's not cultural equality to redistribute it. Second, parties as institutions were the great levelers of American society. Parties were as real meaningful institutions. When they had clout, when they had organization, when they ran elections, when they brought in folks and gave them coal and turkeys and such things, that was when we were able to mitigate some of the inequalities in American society. When we decided that parties and most other institutions, by the way, unions as well, when we decide those institutions are not worth preserving, we want our own freedom, that's what we keep saying. I want to do it I'm an individual, I'm going to vote for the person, not the party. I'm not going to be hemmed in by these institutions and these leaders. I'm going to go my own way, do my own thing. When we go in that direction, we destroy the institutions that help mitigate the inequalities that democracy unleashes. So again, we're at fault here for not, we all got to be constrained if we're going to deal with the inequalities in the kind of culturally diverse society that we have. Put another way, diversity is a very good thing. It's good for the economy, innovation, cuisine, but diversity is bad for democratic government. If you want government to do anything, Madison thought diversity was great because it would slow down government. But we want government to speed up and do more things. And trying to purchase the consent that's necessary to do that gets more and more difficult in the modern American world. Now, what do I tell my students? I tell them what I tell you. I'm not there. I noticed we have a new position at the university yesterday. It bugs the hell out of me. We have a person over there in the Hendricks Chapel who's the sustainability evangelist, whatever the hell that is. I'm not engaged in evangelism in the classroom. I'm engaged, I hope, in hard-headed analysis that tries to get at the truth as I understand it. And that's what I tell my students. Now, if they want to make change, lots of ways to do it, but you don't got to do it through the government, certainly not in the United States. Mary Beth Fry's not here, is she? Oh, there you are. I send them down. If you want to make change, she knows how to make change, and she doesn't do it with any damn government. She does it by her own hook or crook. We at the Samaritan Center feed poor people. We feed them well. We feed them with care. We're engaged in change. So I tell my young folks, go to it. Form a new business. Go help. Go start a new soup kitchen. Go here. Go there. There's much to do. Government is not the only engine of care and change. Okay, who's going to go now? I quit.
One thing that seems to have changed, at least in the recent past, is the level of civil discourse and the degradation of discourse. And can you comment on what effect that is having on the elections, the campaigns at all levels, local up to the presidential?
Well, again, a little bit of this is back to the future. We were, most political campaigns in the 19th century, at any rate in this country, were pretty scurrilous. Ask Mary Lincoln if politics was warm and fuzzy, or Rachel Jackson, or it's always been a blood sport. It's always been rough and tumble. And the notion that somehow or another we're going to take all these disagreements that we have and turn them in to a Tea Party with white gloves is to probably mischaracterize the past and to create an impossibility for the future. Nevertheless, it seems to me the level of discourse in American politics has been degraded. But it's been degraded, it seems to me, by some of the by much of what many people sometimes think of as the advantages of the modern world. Our discourse is going to be degraded here in this community, even more than it already has, by the demise of Stan's newspaper. The demise of Stan's newspaper is a function in large part of all these other forms of communication that we have that allow us to tweet and twit and talk in nonstop, nonsensical phrases at each other without thinking. And we can oftentimes do all of that anonymously. So the degradation of our discourse is a function in part of how we go about talking to one another. My students have a very hard time writing and reading, even honor students. I mean, reading. And so they only know how to talk in these and write in these what I call lists. They're like presidents when they talk. They talk only in grocery lists. Like going to Wegmans, there's the mustard, you know. And that leads to abrupt, blunt, unnuanced, unelaborated argument, which, if there are disagreements, to get through those disagreements, you have to talk carefully for a long period of time. I show my students Sam Watterson's reenactment of Lincoln's Cooper Union speech at Cooper Union. It's an hour and 20 minutes. It's a beautiful speech. It is the speech that made Lincoln president. It is a long, elaborate, and beautiful argument. It was civil, even though he told the South, "You're wrong. Right makes might." But my students can't listen to it. They can't follow it. So until we get back to the written word, in my view, writing thank you notes, and thinking things through slowly, we can't be civil with one another.
Everybody write an letter today instead of an email. How about that? You have a question?
Yes, I was in Syracuse in 1980 at the beginning of the Samaritan Center, and the crisis was, what? Can you hear me? Yes, sorry. And the crisis, the Samaritan Center didn't just emerge. The crisis was the government dropped the safety net, and all of these other institutions fell apart, and the Samaritan Center came up from nothing to feed hungry people. Now, I've spent every year since then working in places like soup kitchens and starting them and running churches that have them, and I think they're an utter failure because there are more and more poor people and more hungry people. And a lot of these institutions, which I support, and I send people to the Samaritan Center and work there myself, it's a lot about middle class people feeling good about helping poor people, but the institution of the poor people keeps growing and growing. So I do challenge your point that you just go and help, because I do think these are larger government solutions, and just putting Band-Aids on them, like giving soup to hungry people every day, creates more and more poor people.
Your point's well taken. I'm not trying to say that government can't do anything or shouldn't do anything, but I'm saying it needs consent to do it. That's all. Now, and consent is more than winning an election by 0.1%. If the government is to be able to sustain its initiatives and its caring and its support for others, I hear you. But I would also suggest that there are many other factors at work in the growing stratum of poor people in this country than simply the failure of government. And I would also want to suggest that I follow a simple rule, and this is me, the conservative. You outed me. I'm a Democrat, but I'm a conservative. If I want to feel a sense of personal control and to some extent feel I am useful in life, then I must try to do things that I can affect and I can see the effect. So it starts with my own life, and then goes to the Samaritan Center or where those local places where I can make a difference. However small the difference is, but I would rather light that little candle than to chafe at the larger darkness that I can't seem to overcome. Now, all the while, I would have voted in favor of the Health Care Act had I been in Congress. But I also know that it's going to be, unless we can convince more folks, convince them, not force them, the implementation of that Health Care Act will not work. It will fail. So we've got to engage a process here, not of demonizing the other guys, gals, but in working this through so that people come to more agreement than we now have.
I think of you as the David Brooks of the Maxwell School. Do you like that analogy?
David and I are both Poll-holics, if any of you read David's column about polls. Here I get up and make a speech, say, you know, all this day-to-day polling stuff doesn't make any difference at all. And just like he does, I look at the damn polls every 3 or 4 hours. It makes no sense at all. We do lots of things that we all know are irrational. I would be pleased any time to be in his category. I'm not, but I'm pleased to be in it.
Professor, on your inequality scale, on your inequality scale, is there any recognizable indicator of where a person is likely to be on that scale?
I'm not sure I quite understand the question.
Is there a division like in education, or what would cause a person to be at the lower end or the higher end? Any indicator on that?
Well, I'll give you the answer that my dear friend and esteemed colleague used to give to that kind of question, Pat Moynihan. And Pat would say, if you stay in school, graduate high school, get married after you graduate high school, and get married and have children only after you're married, the odds of that family being in poverty are extremely low. That's the cultural factor again at work.
I have, all right, it looks like we have time for one more quick question and answer.
Almost out of the emotional part of it, what's your opinion of the Electoral College since the popular vote does not match those maps you started the whole conversation with?
That's right, but the Constitution says that those maps that I started the conversation with are what elect the President of the United States. And so the maps are what's relevant. The popular vote, in any constitutional and legal way, is not the controlling factor. Now, we can all argue over whether or not it should be. I happen to be someone who thinks that the Electoral College is worth maintaining. But it's complicated. I'm happy to talk with you about it afterwards. Suffice it to say, you've got to remember in that second great division that we have that this is a federal republic. And therefore, the states are represented in and a meaningful unit in the Union. A Chief Justice after the Civil War made this comment about the American Constitution. We are an indestructible union of indestructible states. And so the Electoral College is the constitutional expression of the relationship between the states and the central government. The Electoral College was there for many reasons. One, they didn't know how to elect a president of the United States in 1789. Never been done. Nobody had ever tried to elect an executive power. The only executive power they'd ever known was a king, for crying out loud. You couldn't do that. And the only elections, we'd had a lot of experience with elections, but the only elections we'd ever carried out were, the largest level was a county. So with the communication and so forth, how would you elect a president of the United States by popular vote? There were some who wanted to, but they couldn't figure out how to do it. So they came to the Electoral College. It was the last thing they had decided on right before they decided to go home. Now, they had tried they had 15, 20 different ways of electing the President of the United States. They just didn't know how. This was the last one. But one of the reasons it was recommended to them was that they wanted to make certain that there was a support for the president that extended across the whole of the country. They didn't want, to put it bluntly, they didn't want Yankee New England to run the place. They wanted the consent to be broadly arrayed. And the Electoral College, they thought, would facilitate that, and to some extent, I think they were right about that. But it's a complicated question, but the bottom line is ain't going to change, because it will take a constitutional amendment to change it. Ain't going to get it.
Thank you, Bob. We'll look forward to following up with you on November 15th at IRP.